This is the extended podcast version of New Classical Tracks from American Public Media. You'll hear from Leonard Slatkin about his upcoming books, his tour to Asia with the Detroit Symphony Orchestra, his conducting videos, and what it was like to serve as the chair on the jury of the International Van Cliburn competition. I hope you enjoy it. Well, I would love to start by just asking you about the newest experience that you had earlier this month, which was when you served as the chairman of the jury at the International Van Cliburn Piano Competition, something that was brand new to you.
Yes, I've been one of the people who really resented the idea of competition in music. Béla Bartók used to say that competitions were for horses, not artists. But then I realized two things. One, I wasn't in a position to say that unless I'd really seen how it all works. And two, essentially auditioning musicians for my orchestra was in effect a competition, done in a different way. So I thought I would take it on once just to see what it was like and how I might be helpful and perhaps even persuaded that there is benefit in competition.
I know that you were able to help implement a change this time around. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. It occurred to me that since this competition, like so many, always commission a work that all the participants have to play in the first round, that it might be interesting to have a pianist write the piece, who is respected not only as a pianist but as a composer, and then have that person serve on the jury, and that we did with Marc-André Hamelin. We did not ask him to tell us anything about the piece before we heard it for the first time, and it was not until all the contestants had played it and we had already voted on who we thought did it the best that we asked him for his opinion about how the piece goes. So we really tried to approach his work as we would any other composer who we couldn't be in touch with. And I think he was completely surprised at how many different approaches there were to this particular piece of music, which turned out to be very good and I think will serve many pianists well as either an opening piece or an encore on a program.
Were they performing with the DSO?
No. This was done in Fort Worth, Texas. So the first rounds were recitals and chamber music, and then at the end they performed with the Fort Worth Symphony, and I was conducting the finals.
That's what I was trying to get to. You were doing the conducting in the finals, but not your orchestra. Gotcha.
No.
Okay. I just have to tell you that in Minnesota here, we were pretty excited to have a silver medalist.
Yeah.
And so it got me thinking also about how you actually have other roots to Minnesota. Back in 1979, you founded the Minnesota Orchestra Summerfest series.
And before that, I was principal guest conductor, and we had a series of rug concerts. I was a frequent visitor and almost was my second home in a way. I had a really long relationship and wonderful one with the musicians and the public there.
Well, we're thrilled to be able to talk with you and share your most recent thoughts with our listeners. I do want to get to the work that you're doing currently now with the Detroit Symphony Orchestra. I know you're getting excited about your 10th and final season, even though you're not officially leaving. You're going to be coming back and doing other things with the orchestra. What are you most looking forward to in that final season as their music director?
Well, I think it's important to understand why I've given this position up, as well as this year, my other post, which has been in Lyon, France, where I was music director of the Orchestre National de Lyon for 6 years. And I guess I've gotten to a point where administrative responsibilities are starting to wear on other projects that I've either embarked on or wish to embark on. For example, my second book comes out in October. I'm doing a series of arrangements from a vocal group called Singers Unlimited, existed in the 70s and 80s. I'm turning some of their charts into instrumentals. I am doing some more original composition. So I just want to conduct for about 28 to 30 weeks a year and not have to worry about auditions, fundraising, board meetings, things like that. So that being said, I wanted to make the last year here, my final year as a music director, a little bit different. Most people who know my work know that I've championed American music all of my career in life. And in particular, some composers who've come to be very well known both here in the States and worldwide, whether it be John Corigliano, Joan Tower, Chris Rouse, so forth and so on. But I didn't want to commission pieces from them for this occasion. Rather, I wanted to look at the next generation. So I asked each of my friends to give me the name of one of their either current or past students that they would like to see promoted and who they felt really showed the promise to be high quality for upcoming generations. And indeed, that's what we'll do. We'll have 8 pieces by composers who I don't know, but their teachers are opinions that I trust, and I suspect we'll have some very interesting pieces come out of this.
Well, that sounds really exciting.
Yeah, it's one thing we do. A few years ago, we started having festivals in February. As Minnesotans well know, February is not necessarily the best time to be in these northern climes, and many of our major patrons go away, either to the south for sun or even further north to the ski slopes. What we started a few years ago was to implement a festival. First year it was all the Beethoven symphonies in 3 weeks. Then it went to Brahms and Mozart and Tchaikovsky. And for my last year, I thought I'd tie it together with my other orchestra and have a 3-week French festival. And these have proved to be very, very valuable for us because they're attracting new audiences. They give us a chance, like Summerfest did, to reach out and do other things that we wouldn't normally do. We turn our whole lobby and parts of the city into festive areas. With French, there's a lot of collaboration that will go on with the art museum, with various eateries around town. And we're going to have a lot of fun with this. I'm looking forward to it. And then we'll cap it all off with a concert performance of Turandot.
I was recently at an arts marketing conference in May, and one of the things we were talking about was how arts organizations can get more involved in the community. And they brought up the Detroit Symphony Orchestra and how you all reinvented yourself after the strike and how you really have made yourself such an important part of the community. Tell me a little bit about that, how you were able to make that happen.
Each community has to resolve its own problems in its own way. Obviously, in Minneapolis and St. Paul, there were serious issues a few years ago as well. And they seem to have also found different ways to help resolve that, although none of us are out of trouble yet. What happened here was that a 6-month strike took place. And during the strike, although I did not want to get involved with any side, I just don't feel that's my role. I'm an employee of the board of directors, but I'm also the leader of the orchestra, so I like to stand just on the line as opposed to crossing it. But it didn't mean I wasn't advising and listening to everybody as this went on. During the course of the strike, several ideas emerged, one of which the orchestra did itself, as they did in Minnesota, and that was to play in suburban communities. We just decided after the strike was over to keep that going, so now we have a series of 4 concerts, each in 7 different outlying communities. So that increased our subscriber base by 3,500 people. So that helps many things, reaching that community that doesn't want to come downtown, and certainly in the fundraising area that helps. Another thing we did was that we started an initiative that allows students for $25 to buy a card. Anytime there's an event at Orchestra Hall, they 2 weeks before, because we don't have a walk-up crowd here. People tend to make up their minds 2 weeks before. And they just submit the card, either online or however. If there's a ticket available, they're in. And it's $25 for the whole year. And that wound up being, again, a big benefit. We've got about 2,500 sound cards that we issue, and our audiences now reflect a slightly younger demographic than many of our colleague orchestras in the country. But maybe the biggest change was that we were given permission, I think mostly because people didn't think we could do it, to video stream all of our concerts live. And we do that. So more than 25 a year, we get presented all around the world. We have viewerships that can range from 30 to 50,000 people on a single given day or evening. And eventually I wanted to turn it into a revenue stream so people who wish can pay $50 for what we call replay, and they have access to the past 3 years of performances, plus interviews and special things that we do for that. So these three things, I would say, were the main components of how we helped. In addition to that, it wasn't just the orchestra suffering back starting in 2008. It was the entire country, the world, with the economic downturn. Detroit was actually already in trouble before that because of the problems in the automobile industry. The orchestra became one of the leaders in the community of raising awareness for Detroit and helping to rebuild a city which really was thought by many to be on the verge of absolute collapse. So it's quite unusual for an arts organization to have taken a leadership role in, I don't call it reinvent, I just call it reshaping a great city. And I've been very proud of what we've accomplished. I've felt that people know what the orchestra is. They know what we mean to the community. The musicians are out there all the time, not just playing, but being actively involved. One great measurement is that when I arrived here 9 years ago, only one member of the orchestra lived in the downtown area. And the last year and a half, out of our 8 new musicians who joined the orchestra, 7 live downtown.
Wow. That's quite an accomplishment.
Well, I didn't pick the places for them. They just decided to do that.
No, but because things are coming back, you know, and the Detroit Symphony Orchestra has been part of that, as you said, throughout the whole city. You mentioned the free webcasts, and you actually have one coming up as you prepare for your historic Asia tour.
Yeah, the orchestra's never been to Asia before. And this is the first big tour we've embarked during the entirety of my 10 years music director, mostly because we said we would not go on a tour unless we had all the money in hand to go. We didn't want to place ourselves in any economic jeopardy. Fortunately, we have some very notable sponsors, especially within the automobile industry, who have ties to both Japan and China. And they look at this as a business opportunity. So in some ways, not only are we just going to present our music and our art, we're going there as leaders of the community. After all, almost every orchestra has either the name of the city or the state in its name. So that helps a great deal in terms of being able to fundraise and to establish ties with these communities.
I want to talk about the Copland cycle that you've been doing with the DSO. And there's a new recording out featuring the Symphony No. 3, which I know the orchestra has recorded in the past with Naima Yerevi.
Yeah, and I recorded it with St. Louis before, so.
Yeah, yeah. So tell me a little bit about what makes this recording special, because there are some things that are unique about this performance.
Well, it's interesting. I've been recording with Naxos now for quite a while, and much of what we've recorded I had previously done on RCA or whoever it was. And with Copland, what we decided to do was to start off anyway by recording all of the ballets. I'd recorded the 3 well-known ones in St. Louis, but I'd not recorded the other ones, including Grog and Hear Ye, dance panels, things like that. So now we finished the ballets, and I wanted to do the 3rd symphony. The reason I wanted to re-record that, not that I was unhappy with the old recording, although I don't really listen to them once I've made them, but I would say for the last 20 years or so, I've reinstated music that was excised after its first performances. But the excisions came at the suggestion not of Copland, but of Leonard Bernstein. Copland clearly realized that Bernstein was going to become, after Koussevitzky, his chief promoter. And so he listened to what Bernstein had to say. My own findings showed not that Bernstein was necessarily wrong, but I felt that the cuts were just not necessary. They're short. There's a 7-bar one near the end, another one a little bit before that. There's some differences in dynamics. There's some note changes, dynamics that change all the time. But the ending is the big difference. And it creates a much fuller picture of what Copland had in mind. Now, yes, it's bombastic, but you have to remember, we're talking about near the end of World War II. We're talking about a work that was supposed to represent the symphonic picture of the optimism that might be felt at the conclusion of the conflagration. And it does seem silly, well, why re-record it just because it's seven bars? Why don't you just record the seven bars and drop it in your old recording? It doesn't quite work like that, because after so many years, one's conception of the piece changes, of any great piece of music. And clearly the advances in the audio technology have made other differences as well. And finally, just a different orchestra is going to have a different sound for the work. So I was very happy to have another chance to do this and present it, apparently for the first time commercially. Apparently there were versions of Koussevitzky's premiere, and I think one from a broadcast that George Sell did just after that. But commercially, it's never been done that way before. And it gives those who know the piece a chance to hear what Copland intended. And for those who don't know the work, more contemporary way of listening to one of the masterpieces of any of our repertoire, not just from this country, but from all over the world.
Now, that final movement includes a very familiar section, the fanfare for the common man.
It does.
So that's where we often gravitate to, those of us who know the symphony. There are three other movements, though.
Oh, yeah.
What can you tell us about those movements that would help us to listen to them a little more with a fresher ear?
I think it's important to understand that the Copland that most people know, the one from Appalachian Spring and Billy the Kid and Rodeo, Lincoln Portrait, those works come after the Third Symphony. That's very important. And it's important because when you look at earlier Copland pieces, they tend to be more severe, not quite as connected to the outright Americanness, and shall we even say nationalism, that the later ballets encompass. His piano variations, statements for orchestra, other pieces like that were really much more harsh. Some of the early pieces are jazz-inspired. His teacher, Nadia Boulanger, said, when you go back to America after finishing your studies here in France, you and your colleagues are to go and create a real repertoire that is American. And so they delved into many sources, folk music, popular culture, all kinds of things. In this piece, Copland starts us kind of in the world that will be the one that is more reflective of the countryside, almost rural sounding, peaceful when it starts and when it ends. Only when we get to the second movement do we begin to hear the kind of raw-edged Copland. It's a scherzo, but still very consonant. Not particularly difficult to listen to. In fact, I believe it was even used as a theme song for the old Chicago Symphony broadcasts when they were on television for a while. I think it was Chicago, might have been Boston. The third movement, though, moves us now into a much more dissonant language, at least as it starts, for its time in the 1940s. And that leads us into the fanfare for the common man. The first question is, well, which came first? And the answer is that the fanfare came first. And why did it have that title? Because it was originally part of a group of, I believe, 18 fanfares that the Cincinnati Symphony commissioned during the war, but they were all supposed to be themed around American ideals. So you had the fanfare for the Army, the fanfare for the Air Force, the fanfare for the post office. Copland forgot he was supposed to write it, and he asked the conductor, Eugene Goossens, when the premiere was supposed to be, and Goossens said, well, it's going to be on March 15th. At the time when it was written, March 15th was the day Americans paid their taxes. That's when Copland came up with the title, Fanfare for the Common Man. He took the fanfare, changed the key, shortened it up a bit, and used it as the main motif for the final movement, where he also brings in the music of pastoral quality that comes in the first movement. So listen especially towards the end when these two themes come back. And finally, at the very end, with this boisterous music that we haven't heard in 60 years, we hear the full culmination of what the fanfare really means. And it's very striking, and with these additional bars, it becomes even more so. Copland's message of we go through every adversity we possibly can, but eventually we need to come out triumphant.
This recording, the final 10 minutes, features the Latin American sketches. Why did you choose to pair these sketches with that symphony on this recording?
Almost partially by accident. We originally thought it was going to go on with the ballet ones, but the ballet ones went on longer than we expected, so we needed something to fill it out. I don't think anybody these days would just be content to buy a 45-minute symphony on a CD. So we needed it a little bit closer to an hour. We already had it in the can, it was ready to go, and perhaps it shows Copland in a more playful and lighter mood than we get in the symphony. It's a delightful piece, very rarely played. And we had a lot of fun with it. We took it on tour, and the last one reminds one a bit of Copland's ventures into Mexico, when he and Carlos Chavez were working together. You can even hear what I think is Argentinian in the last one, almost reflecting works of Alberto Ginastera.
Why do you think they're rarely played?
Don't know. Just, I think most conductors don't know about them.
Oh, really? Interesting. Yeah. I thought maybe there was some challenging rhythms
not,
or something.
It's not particularly difficult. Third symphony is difficult, but this one's not really that hard. I guess It's scored in a strange way. It's not full orchestra, but it's not chamber orchestra, although I suppose it could be played by smallish forces. But it's a delightful piece for an opener if one wants to have a Copland piece that nobody knows and you want to not start with El Salón, Mexico. This would be a good alternative.
It is definitely an attention-getter. I wanted to ask you about one final thing, and that is the online conducting school series that you're doing. Who is this intended for?
It's a little bit like my first book. I've become very interested in trying to communicate with people who are music lovers as opposed to musicians, people who really want to know a little more about what it is that goes into various parts and elements of working with an orchestra. So the first book, Conducting Business, although it had other elements to it, including partial autobiography, I guess, the main thrust was to tell people, and in the best way I could, what a conductor does. How do we serve as a guest? What's it like to be a music director, working in the opera house, working in the ballet, being on tour, recording, all those things. That was the first book was about that. And from that, I got this idea, and I've been doing it a lot if I go out and I give speeches. At the end of the speech, I teach the audience in 5 minutes how to conduct. I get them all to stand up, and we learn the basics of conducting, the physical basics. Then I thought, well, maybe I could translate that into something that's a little bit of a video project. I'm not really trying to take the mystery out of it so much, but just show people the technique that is involved. I really, up till now, haven't gone into the elements of score study and all that, but that's coming. We're going to get a little more complex, and I think this is going to form the basis for the third book. Second one comes out in October. It's called Leading Tones, and it's more about the industry, about things that I see offering some solutions, including labor strife and matters like that, purely personal, purely opinionated. But I think the next one will combine these videos with some actual methodology and text about how to conduct. It's always bothered me that every conducting book is just a book filled with diagrams, that you don't actually have the means to see how it's done. You wouldn't do that in any other profession in music. You wouldn't take a violin lesson by reading a book. So I don't think you should take a conducting lesson by reading a book. So that's one idea on the back burner. I've had a lot of fun with the videos. We're going to record the next four of them, I think, next week. They're not scripted. I just come out and talk about the elements that go into this, including stage deportment, one of which should be a lesson for me about losing weight, but that never seems to work. And all in all, I think I'll get it up to about 24 lessons. And at that point, it might then start to be moving a little bit too far away from just music lovers. But right now, it's just for people who want to know, how is it done, and what does a conductor have to do with an orchestra?
Oh, that's wonderful. That was what I thought, and then I thought I should just ask you. And I just have one final quick question. What is the hardest concept of conducting that you're trying to explain?
Architecture. It's difficult enough when you're a single musician and you have to play, say, a Bach partita on the violin, and your job is to get from one point to the end. In other words, A to Z, not A to B. But you need to have the technique in order to get you there. It's harder for a conductor because we don't have, and frankly don't want, an orchestra in our living room available to us 24 hours. An instrumentalist or a vocalist or a pianist, whatever it happens to be, can usually practice as much or as little as he or she would like. The conductor does not have that luxury. You sit at home, or wherever it is, and you look at that music, and you stare at it, and you try to come up with a conception of how to put all these bits and pieces together, and eventually, probably without saying it, figure out a way to convey the architecture and the structure to this group of anywhere between 25 and 100 or so musicians. So I would say that's the most difficult thing. Some people say that maybe just the actual communication. I don't think that's the case. In fact, I always found that some of my best early experiences in conducting, in terms of what I learned the most, came when I conducted in countries where I didn't speak one word of the language. And it forced me to have a physical presence that got my ideas to the orchestra, because now I had no verbal way of getting the communication the way I would like it.
That was the extended version of New Classical Tracks from American Public Media. I'm Julie Almacher, with special thanks to Valerie Kaler for producing this episode.